Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with New Hampshire Institute of Politics Executive Director Neil Levesque and political strategist Dante Vitagliano. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Republicans and Democrats are still at a stalemate on a package for disaster relief funding. In consecutive procedural votes, Democrats blocked consideration of a Republican-crafted $13.45 billion package, saying it doesn't include enough aid for hurricane-ravaged Puerto Rico and other U.S. territories. Then, Republicans blocked consideration of the underlying $14.2 billion in a House-passed bill, which didn't include aid for 2019 disasters such as Midwest flooding, because it was written months ago by House Democrats before those storms hit. Both measures were blocked on mostly party-line votes, and neither one mustered the 60 votes required under Senate rule to advance. The House plans to draft a bill this week that would raise limits on discretionary spending for the next two fiscal years. Both parties consider caps set to go into place too strict, but raising funding limits will likely prompt a strong response from the president, who proposed to stick to those caps in his 2020 budget proposal, with the rather large exception that he would increase the defense budget through a war funding account exempt from those limits. And it sounds like Democrats will propose increasing non-defense spending more than defense spending, unlike in years past, where they have pitched or agreed to equal increases in both. That is sure to ruffle Republican feathers, who've often sought the reverse, higher defense spending increases than non-defense. The House Ways and Means Committee is preparing to advance a bipartisan tax bill aimed at boosting retirement savings. The bill would offer tax credits to small businesses to help them band together to offer pension benefits through multiple employer plans and other tax incentives and policy changes favoring annuities and individual retirement accounts could offer significant tools to boost retirement savings as well. The $16.3 billion 10-year cost of the bill would be offset in compliance with pay-as-you-go rules, primarily through a revenue-raising provision that would require most beneficiaries of inherited retirement accounts to empty them within 10 years, rather than hang on to them for decades. A new report says that the average age of structurally deficient bridges in the U.S. is 62 years old, and there are now 47,052 structurally deficient bridges, or 7.6% of all bridges in the country. The pace of upgrades has slowed, requiring some bridges to work longer into old age. The report is being used to prompt advancement of infrastructure-related bills in the House, but there is still no consensus on how to pay for any major new spending. Up next, New Hampshire Institute of Politics Executive Director Neil Levesque will join me to discuss the New Hampshire primary, the history of the IOP, presidential candidates, and more. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Neil Levesque. Neil serves as the Executive Director of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics and Chief of Staff at St. Anselm College. The IOP offers civic engagement opportunities, research and debate of public policy in a state-of-the-art facility, and it has hosted ABC, Fox, and CNN presidential primary debates, as well as many distinguished speakers. Neil has been involved with politics for a couple decades. Prior to joining the IOP, he worked with Congressman Charlie Bass, served with him through five successful elections and 12 years in Congress. He also worked with Morgan Stanley in the One campaign and received his bachelor's degree from Wheaton College in Mass. Welcome to Facing the Future, Neil.
Thanks for having me on.
I want to start off just with the Institute of Politics in general. Maybe for our listeners, you can give just a quick history of the Institute and its role, its ever-increasing role in the primary?
Sure. So a few days before September 11, 2001, a ribbon was cut here at the Institute of Politics by then-Senator Judd Gregg. And it's a 20,000-square-foot facility. There are two auditoriums. There's a full television studio, classrooms, faculty offices, a library, presidential library with 2,800 volumes, and now a polling lab. And so we are operating here nonstop. We have more presidential campaign activity on this campus of St. Anselm College than any other campus in the United States. And as you mentioned, we do host a variety of different presidential things, such as presidential debates. Right now, the CNN town halls are being filmed here. But even when we're not in presidential cycle periods, there's a lot of other activity, political activity. As you know, everyone calls New Hampshire state sport politics, and this is really the hub of all of this activity. So it's a great place to be. And it's a great place to come and participate. Most events are free and open to the public, so we welcome your participation.
And Neil, I agree with you. I think the saying of politics being New Hampshire's sport is right on the money. And how did the IOP get such a prominent and vital role in politics in New Hampshire? And why do you think New Hampshire is such an influential state when it comes to the primary?
Well, the first question really is answered by the fact that we have a lot of supporters in New Hampshire. And a lot of people really decided that we should have sort of a place where it's really the hub for New Hampshire politics. And so there's a lot of great supporters. A lot of them live in the Concord area. And they really support the Institute and what it's doing. And we're very aggressive about trying to bring this activity here. We do about 12 big events a week, and that can be anything from, you know, a big thing of Cub Scouts coming together or a presidential candidate. It's not unusual that when we get into presidential cycles, there could be a candidate here almost every single day. A lot of that's because of our television studio. The other thing about New Hampshire, and your second question is, why is New Hampshire so important and in some cases sort of powerful in this process? And that is because the people here in the state take it seriously. We have the highest voter turnout rates in the nation. The folks really test the candidates out. The great question is, candidates really needs to come here and take a question, but they also need to take the follow-up question. And you really can't do that in other states. You know, big states like California, for example, candidates fly into an airport, they have a press conference, they go to a couple big fundraisers, and they go and they put $50 million or whatever it is on California television stations, and they fly out. It's not that way in New Hampshire. You really can't buy a vote in New Hampshire, and it's a different place. And I think over time, candidates have learned to really love this, and so have the media, as far as the fact that you don't need a lot of money. What you need is some guts, and you need to be able to go out, spend the time, make the case to New Hampshire voters, and go to house parties and restaurants and Main Street and make the pitch to New Hampshire voters. And people who do that are usually successful in the end.
So, Neil, you've been around the block a few times when it comes to the New Hampshire primary and your role with the IOP. How have you seen candidate interaction and use of the IOP change over the years? Has it been a good thing? Has it been a bad thing?
Well, certainly the candidates, each cycle is different. And what we saw with, say, Barack Obama when he was campaigning here in 2008 is he was kind of a rock star. And so you saw him choose bigger venues rather than the smaller venues of traditional candidates. And sometimes incumbent people like vice presidents, Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush, for example, might have picked bigger venues because he was already in office. And then Donald Trump. Now, Trump has said that, you know, I would have loved to have, you know, gone into people's homes or gone to a restaurant, but he was, again, sort of a rock star, very well known. And if he went into a small venue, you know, you could have 2,000 people following him into the restaurant. So he chose larger venues, but we have seen that he came here quite a bit, campaigned very hard here, didn't spend a lot of money on television, and he won. And so I think that what's sort of changed is that the business of politics has developed, and so when there are things like debates and things like that, there's a lot more network money involved and things like that. There's a lot more television preparation for things like that. But overall, generally, it's still candidates coming into living rooms and taking questions. And it's at the heart of American democracy, and it's a great, great thing that we have here, and I hope it continues.
Neil, you mentioned sort of the rock star element that can come with some of these candidates. Does that ever make you nervous about the future of the New Hampshire primary and maybe giving people the idea that they don't have to come in and sit in a living room or sit by a campfire and discuss the issues with voters?
Well, I still think that they're coming here, and there may be bigger venues for some candidates, but not for all. But I think it doesn't necessarily make me nervous. I think that right now what we're seeing is there are so many candidates running, and that there are only so many big venues, if you will. And so what they are doing is they actually are going out and doing a lot of that traditional campaigning. So what we're seeing in 2019 are candidates, some very popular, very in high-profile jobs, such as the U.S. Senate, and they are campaigning one-on-one with New Hampshire voters, and I think that's great, and it says a lot about the potential future of the New Hampshire presidential primary.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Neil Levesque, the executive director of the Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. We're discussing the New Hampshire primary, candidates in it, the history of the IOP, and Neil, I wanted to, one of my burning questions is what are some of your favorite memories in the New Hampshire primary, whether it's an experience at the IOP or some interaction you had with a candidate? You know, what are some of those high-level, really memorable experiences you've had?
Well, I have quite a few of those, and the funny thing is that I get to spend a lot of time with candidates, particularly behind the scenes, so you get to see them. But when Trump first came into New Hampshire, you know, I picked him up at the airport with a Suburban-type vehicle that I borrowed from Auto Fair, so I guess it was a Ford, and he was in the front seat with me, and Cohen was in the back seat, and we bounced around New Hampshire hitting all the frost heaves, and his hair was hitting the top of the ceiling. It's little things like that that are really rather funny. My daughter, who at the time was about 14, walked into a room with Jeb Bush, and he was just wonderful, and he said, "Molly, who's your favorite president?" Now, this is a guy who has a brother and a father who's president, so, you know, there's kind of only one of two answers.
Right, an assumed answer.
Yeah. And she, of course, being that her father is sort of a presidential historian, she said, "Well, of course, President Polk." Well, of course, all presidential historians love Polk, and Jeb Bush immediately just turned it into about a 15-minute riff on why Polk was such a great president, and it was like his favorite president as well. So my daughter loved Jeb Bush, and that was a fun time as well.
And you talked about your individual candidate interactions, and earlier on you mentioned that the I think I mentioned it as well, that the IOP often hosts debates with the candidates. How does the dynamic change from, say, doing like a politics and eggs or a forum with a candidate when you start introducing the debate element with all the candidates on stage?
Well, that's a great question, Chase. You know, when a network is putting on their production, it's very different than when you have the ownership. So on an event like our Politics and Eggs series, it's our event. Everything goes well if we do well, and everything's got to come across. With a presidential debate or, like, say, some of these CNN town hall meetings that we're hosting, those are their events, so the pressure is off us a little bit. They get the candidate. They do all the timeline, the production, et cetera. A lot of times we do the introduction or we help with the audience. So it's very different. In the last cycle, what we saw was that the parties took over the debates, the national parties, because they said, you know what, these should be ours. And so they teamed up with us and with a network. In this case, we worked with ABC News and WMUR-TV, and we put on this these two presidential debates, the only two sanctioned debates to take place in New Hampshire. They're very complicated. Usually by the weekend before the primary, we have some Secret Service involved. That complicates things as far as the audience, who can come in and things like that. But generally, these networks run things very, very well. There's a lot of money involved, and so there's a lot of staff, and it's a much more of a television production, if you will. And, you know, in the last debate with the Democrats, I got to ask a question in front of 8 million people, and it was right before I had back surgery. And I stood up to ask the question, and my entire right side of my body, because I had this very bad injury, went numb.
Oh,
and
no.
I thought on live television with 12 million people, I was going to fall over with the microphone in hand, of course, as I was asking the question. I could not feel my side. It was one of those funny moments, but I got through it, and I won't forget it, I can tell you that.
Maybe reminiscent of a certain candidate falling off stage during a pancake flipping contest?
Yes. People can get that on YouTube. That's Gary Bauer, who was flipping a pancake, and all of a sudden he kind of took a step back. And I will tell you that those stages, a lot of times, when the candidates are looking out at you and they've got their hand in their microphone, they're giving a speech, and they're moving around on stage, a lot of times they don't realize that right they're coming pretty close to the edge. And I've seen that before. Troubled situations. I've seen candidates who, you know, on election night, maybe drank a little bit of alcohol and didn't think they were going to win, and then turn out to win and get on stage, and should not be driving home nor taking the podium. I've seen all of that as well.
So speaking of that, you're sort of going down the trail of surprises along the way during the campaign or in the primary. You have a very well-oiled machine at St. Anselm College at the IOP. Has anything ever caught you by surprise, whether interacting with a candidate or setting up for a debate, where you just thought, holy cow, I'm not at all prepared for this?
Well, we have that a lot, where all of a sudden, before the lights go on, you just never know. So we are the place where the Granite State debates, which are put on by WMUR-TV and the Union Leader, take place. And we've had situations where the candidates are really supposed to be in the building, you know, at least 45 minutes before the debate starts, so they can get makeup on. Everybody wears makeup, by the way. And we've had candidates come in like as short as like a few minutes before the television screens, and we literally do not know if we're going to be able to go live without them. I'll also tell you a funny story that during that same debate that I just mentioned with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley, Hillary Clinton didn't come back from a break right away. So when the television cameras went live, she was not at her podium. And at that point, I thought we might have a missing candidate. I didn't know what was going on. I have to tell you, I did have an anxiety attack. She, in fact, was in the restroom and then came back and famously said, sorry, you know. And then we had, you know, all these sort of political collectors who said, we need to go and, you know, steal the toilet seats off the toilets. And I said, no way, this is not going to happen. But you have any number of crazy things that can happen at one of these things that 15 million people are watching.
You have a lot of photos on the walls of the IOP and a lot of autographs. Is there anything special or particular that you have every candidate do? I know at Politics and Eggs, they literally sign the wooden eggs, but when it comes to just the IOP in general, is there sort of a special ceremony or tradition that you typically invite candidates to participate in?
Well, it's a little more in-depth than that, is that we have our students here that really run this place, and they will do interviews, and we sort of now are kind of requiring them to do these short interviews with our students, and they interact with our students, and they're usually very agreeable to that. You're right about the fact that we have many pictures and artifacts. We have the podium that John F. Kennedy spoke from on Election Day 1960.
Wow.
In Manchester, New Hampshire, that he then got in the car, drove to Boston. He voted and then went to Cape Cod to await returns. We have the champagne glass from the Holiday Inn in Manchester, New Hampshire, that Ronald Reagan filled with champagne, picked up, and toasted his debate victory on the February 23rd, 1980 Nashua High School debate, where he really beat George Herbert Walker Bush.
No kidding.
And so that champagne glass is in our collection as well.
And earlier on in the conversation, Neil, you mentioned that you have a polling center now as part of the IOP. Is that new this cycle? What are you typically working on? Is it issues related, candidate related?
It's all that, and we are about a year into it. We do polling about four or five times a year. We are actually going into the field, as they say, tomorrow, and we're starting up our next polling cycle. We have basically 8 to 10 students, 10 polling stations, where students are on an automated computer system and calling New Hampshire voters, and they say, you know, I'm a student here at St. Anselm College. I'd love to ask you a couple of questions. That introduction in itself, we think we get better results from people who are less likely to hang up. We call cell phones and landlines, and we test the presidential, we test the New Hampshire delegation, and we test different issues. So it's a fairly fascinating process. Gotten some great results, and we're chugging along with that. Our students get to see what surveying is all about. So if they leave and they go into politics, well, they need to know what surveying is all about. If they go and they decide they're going to sell widgets for a living, they need to know that they can test the public and how to test the public to see if something's going to sell. And to see if the public will be interested in buying it.
It's always widgets. They're always selling widgets. Well, if I were to make a little plug, I would be curious to see where voters stand on fiscal policy issues, which is, you know, what the Concord Coalition works on. But setting that aside for a moment, I guess one question I have here, if you were standing in front of a candidate right now or a pool of voters, what advice would you give to them in terms of how to engage in the process and how to plug into the primary and really have their voice heard or their message heard if they're a candidate?
Well, the first thing I'd say is they really need to participate and participate hard here in New Hampshire. I always remember and think about that night of the primary when all the national attention is on this place, and who wins really makes a difference. There's a lot of earned media, sort of all of the special attention you get after you win an election, and whoever wins that New Hampshire primary is going to get catapulted towards Super Tuesday. So I think it's very important, and I think with this many candidates, I think you got to sort of separate yourself and make yourself different and why, and show contrast with other candidates. Right now, the polling shows two very well-known figures, Biden and Sanders, leading the pack. And that may be true in less than a year from now. But the fact is that if that's kind of, I think, more familiarity than it is might be anything else. And this new crop of candidates is starting to take off. I'll give you an example. I hosted Mayor Pete Buttigieg here at the Institute for Politics and Eggs, and then he did our podcast. Shortly thereafter, he went on CNN, he did their town hall meeting, and since then, he has just taken off. Record fundraising levels, he's hitting some good numbers in the polls, he's just taking right off. And it just goes to show that if you're a candidate like him, and you're showing that you can answer questions very intelligently, people are going to be engaged. And that's exactly what he did. He stepped away from sort of the platitudes. And what do I mean by that? It's, let's save the world. Let's all save the world. Together we can all save the world speeches. And kind of got interviewed to a point where he was like, these are real issues. This is how I'm going to solve them. And that was refreshing for voters.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think I appreciate it more when candidates really dive into the weeds and talk about policy, even if it's not terribly popular or even rhetoric-oriented from the campaign trail. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Neil Levesque discuss the New Hampshire primary, the history of the Institute of Politics, presidential candidates, and more. Thank you so much for joining the show, Neil.
Thank you very much for having me on, Chase.
Up next, political strategist Dante Vitagliano will join me to discuss political values, pursuing an issue agenda, voter priorities, and fiscal policy. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Dante Vitagliano.
Dante is a New England-based political and campaign consultant. He's served in various capacities on numerous campaigns at the state, federal, and national level, including New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation presidential primary. Most recently, he co-founded Pinnacle Campaign Strategies in Concord, New Hampshire. His expertise centers on managing and analyzing voter data, campaign operations, and digital campaigning. He's a graduate of Temple University, where he studied political science, focusing on political psychology. Welcome to Facing the Future, Dante.
Great to be here.
Happy to have you on the show, and you joined with some partners to start a consulting firm. We're both millennials, so I'm curious, what's it like to hang your own shingle, start your own shop?
Well, it's fantastic. Get along great with the boss, but there's obviously a good amount of pressure to, you eat what you kill. There's also a component of where's the value add.
And I had you on the show today because I want to talk about a variety of things, some of the broader topics like political values, what it's like to set an issue agenda,
sure,
how fiscal policy ties into some of these issues. But maybe I'll go even more basic than that just to kick it off. What's it look like to run a campaign these days? Is it a radically changing environment, or are there still some pretty steady principles because it is, in fact, politics?
Well, I would say that it's a mixture of both, of course, and I know that sounds like a cop-out answer, but it is a radically changing environment. Now, there's a good amount of innovation taking place in the vendor space and the technology space, and the strategies that we're employing now are very, very different than in past cycles, and every cycle is different, and that's something that is can be difficult for candidates and elected officials to keep up with, but it's something that we prioritize in helping our clients utilize the best tools, research, data, insights available. At the same time, you have to recognize a sort of back-to-basics approach. At the end of the day, it's really all about message. Mm-hmm. Our job here as campaigners, as policy advocates, is ultimately to motivate political behavior. And it could be, to take action, take a particular call to action. It could be just to go vote, but it's to get people off the couch and taking action on a political issue.
You really emphasize empirical data and data collection.
Absolutely.
To help craft some of those tactics or messaging. So I guess a question I have is, when you're working with a candidate or a client, what's the process like of crafting that message? Is it you present a significant amount of data and say, here's what we're seeing, or does a candidate walk in the room and say, here's what I really want to communicate, how can I do it best?
Well, there has to be a balance of authenticity, what the candidate, their motivations for running for office in the first place. They have their own ideas, their own values, and their own perspectives, and their thoughts on issues, and those need to be articulated authentically. At the same time, the sort of term data-driven is thrown around a lot in political consulting these days, and that can mean really anything. It could mean anything from, we run a large-scale field poll and then base our strategy off of that piece of what I call snapshot survey data, or what we're sort of advocating is a long-term iterative approach, where you build all of your systems, whether it's your social media, your internal communications, your email messaging, all of the different systems that you employ, all the strategies and tactics that you employ, all take an iterative approach. So you're measuring, tracking, and ideally improving your messaging and your product going forward throughout the campaign.
And Dante, as we move to being a more technologically advanced society, and you see things like social media really become a dominant player in marketing and campaigning and even policy communicating.
Certainly.
Is there a shift away from that usual handshake interaction with a voter, or is that still a pretty vital aspect of working on messaging and working with campaigns?
Well, it depends. I mean, in New Hampshire, it's certainly still highly valued in retail campaigning and face-to-face interaction. If you have the opportunity to do it, the best advocate for a campaign is always the candidate. And if you have that opportunity to get the candidate in front of people, get them to shake hands, look people in the eye, articulate their positions on issues, then I think that is absolutely the best approach. But that doesn't mean that text messaging or social media are replacing retail politics. They just serve a different function. And in many cases, the tech tools that you use are more geared towards motivation and mobilizing your supporters, giving them opportunities to contribute and to help the campaign, whereas the persuasive aspect, you're not going to be terribly persuasive in a text message. That's just these types of non-personal tools are better utilized for organizational purposes versus persuasion. The most persuasive interaction that you can have is a face-to-face interaction, even if that's with a volunteer or a surrogate or, you know, a member of the staff. But there are ways to utilize these tech tools for information collection purposes that help you become more persuasive, help you make your message more accessible, and tailor your communications to be more persuasive in the field.
So, Dante, a question I have, going back to sort of the empirical data collection, especially in the primary, you see a lot of polls coming out on particular issues or on particular candidates. And then sometimes you'll see an election occur and the polling data is very disconnected from whatever the results are from an election.
Polling is tough. And that's, you know, I'm happy not to be a pollster. There are people that are much more qualified and better at doing it and understand the nuances and how to craft more accurate and actionable insights from survey data. But an example of supplementing survey data that I saw just the other day, somebody on Twitter, I think a political journalist, made note that Elizabeth Warren was using a text message that to allow you to tell her why you didn't want to vote for her. Or if you text feedback, I've done it. I didn't tell her anything. I just wanted to see if it worked, by the way. In any case, she has that tool, and her campaign has created presumably created a system, whether they're using sophisticated natural language processing or just simply reading the verbatims of what people text back. That's all insights that she can use to better understand her vulnerabilities, what her voters are looking for, and that can help to make the message more persuasive over time.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Dante Vitagliano from Pinnacle Campaign Strategies. We're discussing some of the empirical data collection methods and communication aspects of a campaign. And I think what I want to switch to now, Dante, is how do you strike a balance when you're working with a candidate or a client on the right kind of communication? So, for instance, I get, because I'm on everyone's email list for the primary, I get 30 emails a day from the same candidate. You know, donate now. We've got a deadline. Here's the issue you should care about. What are the driving factors for communications like that, and how do you find the right balance?
I think you touched on something there. You mentioned we have a deadline, and this is something that's been studied by political scientists and academics who are far more qualified to speak on this than I am. But it's something that we take very seriously, is trying to keep up on the latest psychological, political psychology, and behavioral trends. We found most recently that the most persuasive in terms of motivation types of messages are what we call, or they call in social science, negative descriptive social norms. So that would be something like, we're working so hard, but the donations just aren't coming in. Our opponents are stacking money like crazy. Help us, step in and do your part. Versus a positive social norm, which would be, everyone's doing it, come along with us. And that's far less persuasive, we're finding, than something like a doom and gloom. This is pervasive in the email fundraising.
So it's not just a hunch. There's actually data to back up that, wow, that's interesting.
I do think it's interesting, because in many other aspects of marketing, the be part of the winning team is a more persuasive. But for this application, the threat of losing, of your side losing, whether it's an election or just on an issue, that seems to be the threat seems to be a more powerful motivator than being part of the winning team.
Am I wrong in thinking that this is a relatively new trend in the last decade or so? Because I'm thinking back to when President Obama ran for office, and it was
hope
and change. Yes, we can seem very inclusive and optimistic, as opposed to, oh my gosh, the sky is falling, we need to win sort of mentality.
Well, I would venture to guess, and I can't say that I remember what the digital campaign looked like for the Obama campaign. But I would imagine that while there's candidate messaging, the campaign probably messaged against the opposition pretty aggressively. Probably what fueled a lot of their online donation success. Ideally, you want your campaign and your candidate to represent the positive values, what you stand for, what you want to do, what you hope to bring to the table. What's your contribution? What's your unique value proposition? Why you? Whereas the campaign can get a little bit more, well, like they can be the attack dog.
You're looking at the polls. You're looking at the data. What are the issues rising to the top right now? And what do you think is driving the rise of those issues?
Well, it's hard to say because there's different ways of looking at it. For example, when we talk about large-scale field survey, snapshot data, the kind of research that's done by Pew, Gallup, and other and polling organizations, we see that, for example, there are evergreen issues, healthcare, education, national security, the economy. No matter how good the economy is, it's still somehow an issue. Not a normative statement. It's just an observation. Whereas issues like the budget deficits, fiscal issues don't always maintain an evergreen status.
I can attest to that.
I sympathize because I do think that it's not, and not only fiscal issues, but there are a lot of very important issues that will get pushed to the back burner. Mm-hmm. And there's a debate or an ongoing conversation within the political science community as to, you know, what truly determines the prioritization and public opinion. And at the end of the day, there's really, you know, three major factors, and it's your peers, leaders, and the media. And certain issues will become more marketable, more accessible, more, and thereby prioritized by the voters at different times based on, you know, it could be circumstances, current events. We often find that, for example, after a mortality reminder, sort of a disastrous event, things like terrorism will rise to the top.
A crisis.
Right, yeah. A crisis. And that will, that sort of mortality reminder will trigger in voters' minds a priority that this should be something that should be addressed, which kind of circling back to the, you know, fiscal issues. It's difficult, I think, for most people to truly visualize what that catastrophe is.
Right.
Actually looks like. And the non-tangible nature of the issue itself, I think, determines where on the priority list this issue falls. So while it may not be a priority right now, Pew Research, looking back at 2013 and 2014, fiscal issues ranked much higher
in terms
of voter priorities and their political values. Well, what do we take away from that? Were people just more educated at the time? Were they just more in tune? I'm skeptical of that.
Timing is everything.
Exactly. I think personally, it's my position that when fiscal issues were tied to a particular crisis, that being, you know, raising the debt ceiling, mm-hmm. and a potential breakdown in conversations in Congress. That was a very real crisis,
right,
that people understood. They might not have understood the fiscal issues themselves, mm-hmm. but they understood that the budget deficit was an issue for Congress, and it was causing gridlock, mm-hmm. and the gridlock was causing turmoil. And that turmoil got enough play in the media that the voters then understood this is an important issue. And now that it's an important issue, now we need to tailor our thinking to have a position on that issue.
Yeah. And I think to that point, you know, 2013 was on the heels of the Great Recession. We were just kind of getting back to a point of economic growth. There was a lot of political gridlock, debt ceiling debate. I think we even had a partial shutdown that year.
Sure.
So, you know, fiscal policy was front of mind. And fast forwarding to the 2019 poll, I looked at it as well and saw that the budget deficit was 14th on the list of priorities for voters.
Near the bottom.
But issues related to fiscal policy, like the economy, health care, Social Security, Medicare, were four of the top six issues.
Certainly.
And for me, sure, like you said, there are evergreen issues. The economy is always going to be in the conversation. But to me, that communicates not only is timing everything, but also organizations like the Concord Coalition need to find ways to connect the issues that people can identify and frame it and tie it into the broader.
Absolutely.
So my question to you before we have to get going is for an organization like us or any issue or organization, when you're looking at data like this and trying to frame a message, what advice would you give or what tangible steps do you think they should take to help frame that message?
Well, first and foremost, when you start talking about fiscal issues and budget deficits, I think the first thing that's called to mind is cuts. And there's a quote from Senator Jim DeMint, there's no political value to cutting anything. And I think he's right there. You know, when you
that's certainly the case right now for Congress.
Well, it's not popular. And so what he's saying is, and it's a very sort of unoptimistic, it's a sort of pessimistic view, is that there's no political value for our leaders to cut anything. And when it's framed as a cut or slashing budgets and removing resources or taking things away, that I think you're in a losing battle almost every time. Whereas if there's any way to reframe the conversation to be about solving problems. So if there's a particular problem, whether it's healthcare or another issue, who do you think is best suited to solve this issue? Or where are you getting the best customer service experience? Mm. Are you getting it from the DMV or from Amazon? Well, I think a lot of people would say Amazon.
I love the DMV. I don't know what you're talking about, Dante.
There's a lot of innovation taking place in the private sector. And maybe asking the question, you know, how do we best utilize the innovation taking place in the private sector to solve some of society's biggest issues? That's a very different conversation. Mm. But it's ultimately getting at the same issue, which is how do we provide people with the services and goods that they need in a way that is fiscally responsible? And if we can offload, you know, some of these burdens, budget burdens, to private sector, which may or may not, in many cases, may be better suited to solve that problem, then maybe we can get somewhere with the conversation that gets us away from the slashing, cutting, taking away.
Yeah, certainly on campaigning, it's easy to focus on the negative. But when it comes to policy reform, the negative can come back to bite you pretty hard when you're talking about cutting things.
Nobody wants to hear that.
Nobody wants to hear that. And that's not something that the Concord Coalition is necessarily advocating for. That's not how we try to frame the message. But one final question I've got for you. How can, in the era of social media and a 24-hour news cycle and the political reality of talking about the negative could be bad for your reelection possibilities, how
Sure.
can the average voter or a group of voters help steer the conversation toward the need for reform?
I just want to take a step back real quickly and say that what the Concord Coalition and similar groups do is actually a very vital function. Because there are,
well, thank you, Dante.
And of course, I'm biased and being here, but there's two main avenues for shaping public perception on a particular issue and agenda setting. And the first is education and just simply talking about an issue. You talk about an issue enough, people will have to have a position, if it's whether it's important or not. If it gets talked about and it becomes important, so because perception is everything, and reinforcing and encouraging the conversation about fiscal issues is really step one. So that, I think, is
check.
Exactly. That's an important, a very important function. And then you start getting into agenda setting and the frames and how the issues are framed. But I would say that having a conversation, instead of talking about, you know, modern monetary policy, and people's eyes are glazing over already, but instead talk about or have a conversation about solving problems, or about how to best utilize innovation. I think people get innovation. They know that, you know, a couple of years ago they couldn't get an Uber anywhere. There was no such thing. And Amazon, you can order. I could have ordered, you know, an entire bed set, have it delivered during this interview, and, you know, set up for a nap after this. But I think that people understand that innovation is making their lives better. And so, how can we best utilize it? How can we best encourage and empower the most innovative among us to help us solve those biggest problems?
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Dante Vitagliano from Pinnacle Campaign Strategies. We've been discussing political values, pursuing an issue agenda, as well as some fiscal policy relating to voter priorities. Thank you for joining the show, Dante.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.